Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And yesterday, as you probably heard, Beverly Young Nelson accused Roy Moore of sexually assaulting her when she was 16 and he was 29. It's the fifth and most brutal charge leveled against the Republican Senate candidate. In her statements at a PAC news conference, she revealed her recollection of what he told her after the assault.
He said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
And then she showed reporters this, which she described and read from her high school yearbook.
He wrote in my yearbook as follows: "To a sweeter, more beautiful girl, I could not say Merry Christmas. Christmas 1977, love, Roy Moore, Old Hickory House." And it signed it, Roy Moore, D.A.
With me now to talk about this most recent allegation, and even more to guide us through this moment in a larger legal and cultural sense, is Rebecca Traister, a writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of the book All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Her latest article in New York Magazine is called Your Reckoning and Mine, as stories about abuse, assault, and complicity come flooding out. How do we think about the culprits in our lives, including sometimes ourselves? She says, hi, Rebecca. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be here.
Want to comment on this latest Roy Moore allegation?
Yeah, I mean, that the news conference was really painful to watch, because you think, and in a funny way, it's symptomatic of so much of this explosion that's happening. You know, there are stories every day in so many industries about harassment and also about assault and rape. And there are stories in many cases that have been buried for decades. And so this individual story yesterday, one of the things that was so moving about it is that she was weeping. This was clearly a formative, painful experience that shaped her and has tortured her for decades. And I was so struck by the fact that even when this guy became the Senate candidate, you know, which is months ago now, she still didn't come out with this story. This is just something she had so internalized, his promise that no one would believe her, that she's just a child. And it's not crazy that she internalized it, because, of course, these things happen all the time and people don't believe the women. They do. The men who wield more power and who tell their victims that they wield more power are correct. They've wielded more power.
And she says she told her husband before they got married. She told her mother a few years ago. And so reporters maybe will find them, I don't know if her mother's still alive or not, and, you know, corroborate that the story is not something that she's just making up now. Plus this documentary evidence, you could tell by the way she was emphasizing certain words that she at least now, and probably then or close to then, saw it as a little creepy that this DA was signing her yearbook to a sweeter, more beautiful girl, I could not say Merry Christmas, and then signed it Love. It was suggestive.
Well, and then notes the name of the restaurant, you know, where the assault, she describes the assault as happening outside this restaurant near a dumpster. Now, one of the things, Roy Moore denied this yesterday, really vehemently.
Yes.
This didn't happen.
Yes.
I've never even heard of that restaurant. You know, and yet here he is noting the name of the restaurant. But this is the idea that this guy can think that he can just say, no, I never heard of this restaurant. This never happened, you know, and you're all going to believe me, right? There's a lot of history to back up that perspective, right? He's not crazy to try this. This is essentially what Donald Trump did a year ago, and he still won the presidency. I mean, you know, the dynamics here are really complicated.
One other thing about about Roy Moore yesterday. We also learned that in the 80s, he was banned from a shopping mall in his hometown, Gadsden, Alabama, for bothering teenage girls, it was reported. What do you know about that story?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that in the local press there, apparently there were longtime rumors. Again, this was a kind of known whisper network rumor thing that there was this guy, the town DA, who picked up young women at the mall. I mean, remember, the first most prominent accuser reported last week in the Washington Post was 14 years old, and she reported unwanted physical contact, his touching her. There are now five accusers. You can bet that there are likely more than that. And this was something that was kind of whispered about and known in the community where it had happened, and yet had never been considered newsworthy enough or valid enough to discredit this man's very powerful career, which has now, you know, become a Senate candidacy and perhaps a place in the U.S. Senate.
And we will see what happens after the Access Hollywood tape, which was Donald Trump, in his own words, he still got 53% of white female voters just a month later.
And this case has been making me think about the Trump conversation we had a year ago. Yes, there was his own admission that you can grab women if you're famous enough and powerful enough that you don't even need their permission. There's that on tape.
Yes.
Then there are more than 20 women who accused him of assault, not just harassment, of grabbing them, kissing them, groping them on a plane. Then there are other recorded instances of Donald Trump, for example, looking at a teenager going up an elevator in one of his buildings, a 12-year-old, and saying, I'm going to date her in a couple of years. I mean, that's on video. That is not some rumored thing. There are lots of instances of Donald Trump looking at underage girls saying, oh, she's going to be my girlfriend in a couple years. I'm going to date her in a couple years. I mean, this is not a secret.
I guess the difference that some people who are Trump supporters but not Roy Moore supporters would say is all we have with him is talk, you know, big talk, locker room talk. Melania said boy talk. Here we have evidence of action.
Right. Although we do, again, I want to return to the fact that there were more than 20 women who accused him of more than talk, of groping them. There was a reporter for People who told an extremely detailed story of how when she was reporting on Trump and Melania at their home, he had her in a room and kissed her against her will, holding her against a wall. I mean, that's more than talk. That's assault, that sexual assault, as well as a woman on an airplane who said his arms, like octopus arms, groping her during a flight. I mean, and that was those were reported in major newspapers. So it was more, the allegations were certainly that he did more than talk. And his admission was that he grabbed even without permission.
Rebecca Traister with us from New York Magazine. In your article, you talk about the torrent of stories coming out now being obviously powerful, that it makes people mad, that it makes people sad, that it makes some women feel empowered. But you say it's also incredibly confusing. What's confusing about it?
Well, this is an entire sort of new way of looking at the dynamics that have undergirded our professional lives, our personal lives, our friendships. And there are all these things. It's not just that some people feel, you know, thrilled and happy about this, and some people are worried about what's going to happen next. It's that the same people feel both exhilarated, some of them, by the fact that we're telling these stories in a way that they've been suppressed for so many years, for generations. Even when they were told, they weren't taken seriously. They didn't really count. I mean, you can look at some, like Donald Trump is a great example of that. Bill Cosby, there were on the record detailed reports of his alleged assaults and rapes, and it didn't matter. He kept getting lifetime achievement awards, right? This has been standard operating procedure that even if these stories came to light, they didn't really do any damage to the men who were accused of often repulsive and criminal acts, right? It just nobody seemed to care that much. So there's a kind of exhilarating moment here where suddenly we're caring about these things that have shaped women's fortunes and their lives and done tremendous damage to some of them. And suddenly people seem to care and it's on the front page of newspapers and people are taking it seriously. That is
not confusing.
That's important and it's revelatory. At the same time, there are so many other feelings about how we've all operated within this system, because it's not just about the individual stories of a particular person who committed serial harassment or assault, or a particular person who suffered those things. It's also about the fact that increasingly, as more stories of workplace harassment and sometimes assault come out, we understand so many of our workplaces to have been affected by this. Who got ahead? Who got promoted? Who was taken seriously? We're beginning to think about the fact that it's not even necessarily just about, did a boss grab you or come on to you inappropriately or, you know, treat you badly after you were buffed in advance, but how did you react and how did that determine your fortune? That it's not always about the aggression or the come on or the groping or the assault. It's also about then how women and some men react to those things that determines in part their professional fate. And all kinds of larger systemic questions about perhaps this is why women drop out of workforces. One of the reasons they drop out of workforces or go to more female-dominated workforces that are often less well paid. There are so many confusing things happening at the same time.
We will take some phone calls for Rebecca Traister. Our lines are filling up, so let me make sure everybody has the number. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Another thing about the confusion. In your article, you write, the rage that many of us are feeling doesn't necessarily correspond with the severity of the trespass. Lots of us are on some level as incensed about the guy who looked down our shirt at a company retreat as we are about Weinstein, even if we can acknowledge that there's something nuts about that, a weird overreaction, unquote. So what accounts in your mind for that overreaction, if it is an overreaction?
Well, I think there are a couple of different factors. First of all, lots of us have suffered zillions of these mini things, I guess what people call microaggressions, right? The thing, the guy looking down our shirt or staring at our boobs or making comments about how we're dressed or how we're looked. Stuff that is not traumatic to many of us, maybe traumatic to some people. Stuff that is not traumatic, that's the kind of stuff we laugh off and we brush off. But when you encounter it so often, when your life is so much of your energy is spent navigating that kind of crap, the resentments that nobody seems to understand how regularly this happens or that it does sort of have a cumulative impact on you and how you view your place in the public sphere or in relationship to your colleagues, that stuff accretes. And it, you know, also lifetimes spent in which even the graver stuff isn't really taken seriously and you're expected to laugh it off or power through. And if you complain, you may receive blowback. All that stuff has built up in a lot of us so that it all exists on the same scale. And the other thing that I mentioned before is that so much of it has been about how we react to even the little stuff. Like, do you laugh at the offensive joke in the meeting? And if you don't laugh at it, then are you the humorless, unpleasant woman who nobody really likes in the office? Are you kind of considered maybe a threat because you might not play along? Therefore, do you get a little bit less respect or affection or professional affiliation with your colleagues? Do you pay for not playing along? And then if you do play along, are you taken less seriously because you play along? Or do you get ahead because you've played along? And then do you wonder why you got ahead? Was it because of your talents? All those questions that are the form and substance in many cases of how women view themselves within their own professional spheres. And I think the buildup of all of that and the moment where we can sort of say, look at what this experience, what this life of being in the working world is like for women. It's not just about the individual grave assaults, though in some cases it is. It is also about the accumulation of having to spend the energy and time navigating this kind of behavior every day for years at a time.
Diane in Bridgewater, you're on WNYC with Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. Hi, Diane.
Oh, good morning and thank you. Believe me, I detest the idea of someone like Ray Moore before even this came out. But I'm curious about a couple of things some of these women are saying. Having been groped in my 30s in a room with a doctor and never thought to ever report him. This woman with the yearbook, how old was she when she graduated high school? And if she was older, why would she give him her yearbook to sign? And the other one from Hollywood, I think, who said she was raped twice by the same man.
So on the Roy Moore, you understand her question about timeline. If the rape took place at 16 and she graduated after 16, why would she had given Roy Moore, her attacker, her yearbook to sign?
Well, I mean, that's a question. There are all kinds of...
Or why would he have noted the location of his rape?
Well, I think that's a place, you know, again, the way that women are expected to behave after having been harassed or in some cases assaulted or raped, the ways in which women are pressured to behave varies. And so there are all kinds of instances. It is extremely well documented that there are plenty of women who have been harassed or attacked and who maintain relationships with their attackers, even if they are traumatized, even in fact, sometimes because they are traumatized, because they don't want it to happen again, because they want to convince themselves that it didn't happen, because the attackers scare them. A million different psychological responses lead women often to have all kinds of relationships after traumatic events, after instances of harassment or even of violent rape. The person who I believe you're referring to, who has written at length about how she continued her relationship with Harvey Weinstein, is Asia Argento, an Italian actress. And she has written very movingly about the sort of psychological games that she played after having been violently raped, I believe, by Harvey Weinstein, and continuing a relationship with him, in part because she didn't want to sort of grapple with the idea that she'd been so badly hurt. There are plenty of women who are very anxious to not be the victim, to not concede or admit or fully feel the degree to which they've been damaged by something like this, and try to make themselves powerful by getting some advantage back. There are all kinds of psychological reactions. And the one thing I want to emphasize is that I don't think it's possible to diagnose or to evaluate whether or not an alleged instance of rape or harassment occurred based simply on how the women reacted after, because there are so many variations of that. You yourself said that after your groping, you didn't report the doctor, and somebody could very easily come back and say, oh, well, if you didn't report him, why are we supposed to believe that this actually happened? You know, they're all, you know, and you would have a very logical answer to that. But so would many of these other women who continued all kinds of different relationships with men who had attacked them.
Thank you. I never would have thought of that.
Diane, thank you very much. And to this point, kinda, you talked to women for your article who were nervous to bring up stories of their bosses or coworkers sexually harassing them because they were worried about the men. And I was struck by this point, I think you were too, that as a society, women are conditioned to worry about the well-being of men over their own, even when these men are harassing or even assaulting them.
Right. And I want to say that I don't think it's wrong to worry about the men. I worry about the men, right? Even as I acknowledge that I think that they should be, that the men who have committed real criminal acts or should perhaps lose their jobs, should certainly face public censure, should face censure of some sort, should have consequences. But at the same time, of course, I think about their futures, their families, the kind of impact it has on them. I worry. My anxiety is that we don't worry in the same way about women who've been systematically disadvantaged by this kind of behavior for generations. It's quite easy to think, oh, gosh, these guys, yes, he did a terrible thing, but God, he's going to lose his job. He's going to be drummed out. I don't think it's wrong to feel that way. But I do think what we have to adjust ourselves to talk about more is think of the women who've been drummed out of the workforce. Think of their families. Think of the women who make less money, who've been humiliated in their workplaces, who've been victimized, who've left professions entirely. And there's actually really great reporting by a researcher who's talked to Marketplace about 50% of women in one study left their jobs after experiences of harassment. And when the harassment was particularly severe, 80% of women left their jobs within 2 years. That does damage to women's careers. And yet we don't afford women that same kind of sympathy. Like, oh my God, what must this be like for them? What have they lost? Who's suffering because of this behavior? So it's not so much an argument against feeling for the men. It's that we must also think about the damage that's been done to the women.
And you write about how some women are writing to you thinking about how they've been complicit and how they participated in the system. Maybe the most intriguing example in the article was the woman who worked for New Republic editor Leon Wieseltier.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I used to work for the New Republic, though not with Leon Wieseltier, who's since lost his job, a new magazine that he was supposed to start.
Because of these revelations.
Because of revelations that over a period of decades he engaged in behaviors that are now sort of clearly viewed as sexual harassment, kissing subordinate women against their will, commenting subordinate women on, you know, thanking them for wearing short, tight skirts to the office, threatening, you know, jokingly threatening to tell a subordinate woman who displeased him that they were having an affair if she displeased him. I mean, that stuff that now very clearly looks like harassment. But because I worked at the New Republic, you know, I know plenty of women who knew Wieseltier and worked with him, and many of whom were mentored by him. And several of them have talked to me about how difficult this has been because they cared for him and they were grateful for his mentorship. And they acknowledge that the reports about him are true and that they're bad. But they also wanted to talk about how confusing it is, because if you were a young woman who he picked to mentor, even if you had to endure some of this behavior, mentorship from men is still so rare in so many industries. And they describe the way that Leon made them feel supported professionally and helped their careers. And that is a very powerful thing that lots of women are grateful for, especially given that there's so little support for women's careers in so many places. So and so it's a lot of conflicting feelings.
Right.
But many of them who also were his mentees and his proteges also talk about reviewing the way they played along with him. Obviously, in many cases with more minor offenses, flirtatious comments, sort of a little bit of light leering, and how, in part, there was a kind of pride in like, I can handle Leon. And now thinking retrospectively about what that meant and what did it mean that some of the mentorship that they indeed prized and valued and feel genuinely sad about right now, as they do feel genuinely sad for him, what did they do? How were they complicit in order to get that mentorship on the one hand? And also lots of people in lots of professions and workplaces thinking about who was harassed and who wasn't harassed. What did it mean if he or another sort of harassing boss didn't pick out women, you know, as his favorites, who he was going to both slightly harass but also support? I mean, these kind of hierarchies of who got the support and at what cost are very confusing within women's heads, too.
So those things may have coexisted, maybe in his case and maybe in some others, where those who the male boss considered attractive were harassed but also got professional benefits, mm-hmm. and those who were not considered attractive were ignored on both levels.
Right. And what happened to those women if they were ignored? But inversely, I also spoke to a woman at a different workplace who told me she was harassed along with another young person. And she described the inverse of that, saying, what about all those serious women who weren't harassed? We were treated like we were sexual objects, the other woman and I who were harassed. But all these other peers, my other colleagues who are women, apparently they were serious. So the harassment in her case made her feel like she wasn't taken seriously professionally. The degrees, the different angles in which this cuts, this is part of why even the small stuff accretes, because it's so complicated and so many women have spent their careers working their heads around this. And apparently men didn't know the energy and the time and labor we were putting into trying to navigate it all.
Edson in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Rebecca Traister. Hi, Edson.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm from Brazil, and in Brazil, we see things different. I remember when I came to America, I had a cultural shock. Because of in Brazil, you know, a lot of women, they treat as an object of desire. And then I see over here, as in Brazil, that there is signals from the culture at large that, you know, we look at the women as an object of desire, erotic. And then when I'm walking around over here in Manhattan, I see a lot of beautiful women. And sometimes I pay them a compliment. And I know, you know, back in my mind, now I know that it's incorrect. How I'd like to ask your guest, how we react with the signals that we receive from the culture at large, you know, the way that the culture put women as an object. And since kids, since they are young boys, they look at the women as an object of desire. How can we separate that stuff?
Well, I want to assure you that it is not just in Brazil in which these signals are sent. And even though things are changing in some communities here in the United States, I just want to remind you that a year ago when this stuff came up about Donald Trump, the excuse that many of his supporters used was, this is just locker room talk. This is just how men are. So it's not as though the rules are entirely different, and certainly not as though our history here is entirely different. I think the question you have to consider when thinking about women as sexual objects is this the scale on which we're evaluating human beings, right? And it's not that, of course, women and men have sexualities, they desire each other, they find beauty in each other, they're attracted to each other. No one's saying that that stuff isn't allowed. What we're talking about is the question of what is done to women sort of as a class, as a gender, when they are weighed on scale, on aesthetic scales, on sexual scales, when their value is attached to their desirability, not, for example, to their professional capabilities, to their talents, to their brains, when they are not considered professional, public, political equals, and when they are treated, as you say, as sexual objects, an object of male desire in which men are the actors and women are the objects of that action. And it's about considering the harm that is done to women more broadly when those are the lenses through which you're viewing them and the world.
We're about out of time, but I want to read one other couple of lines from your paragraph, from your article, because I think they're so important, and we're going to have more conversations about this aspect of it coming up on the show, but about these well-known men now being brought down in such numbers in a short period of time. You still say it's a drop in a bottomless bucket, and then, quote, maybe we can get another two horrible people to have to step down or say they're sorry, one Democratic lawmaker told me, but that helps only 20 people, and it's 20 million who need things to change. Plus, you're a farm worker, a lady who cleans offices, you're a prostitute or an immigrant, you're not going to tell your story. And that's where it gets even more scary, because in a way, there's some, you know, there's more hope if you can finger somebody who's a public figure, because there's at least some chance that there'll be a lot of press.
Right.
And that situation will start to get remedied, but not in ordinary workplaces.
Absolutely. It's both about the notoriety or the power of the accused, but it's also about the economic stability and security of the accusers. So that, by and large, one of the reasons that this is happening in elite professions to famous men is both because the men are interesting enough to our news media to report on, and because the women who are telling their stories have enough kinds of security, whether that is economic security, they're in highly paid professions, they have social networks to whom they can fall back on, who've encouraged them to do this, they have access to the news media, so that and we all know that predators specifically target really vulnerable people, so that in lower paid professions, amongst poor people in the tipped professions where abuse and harassment is rampant and where workers rely on the tips of their customers, you're talking about millions of people in America who don't have anything like the economic security, the job security to be able to make these allegations and feel like they're going to be okay if they suffer retribution, that they have any kind of safety net. Low wage workers, minimum wage workers, farm workers who actually made a statement in solidarity with Hollywood women this week. These are the people we haven't heard from, but where abuse and harassment happens at least as often, and in many cases more often and more horribly, and there is no security, there is no economic stability, and therefore for so many of these workers, there is none of the recourse that we're now seeing in the more elite and highly paid professions.
Does it make that harder to write about?
Yes, it's very hard to write about, because you want to be, and one of the tolls I understand the necessity of individual stories about individual men who are individually interesting to us. But one of the things that we must get across is this is systemic, and that people are suffering in all kinds of professions. Women are disadvantaged in all kinds of professions that are not going to get that same kind of individualized ink. And we have to make sure we understand that this is structural and architectural in terms of how women are treated in workplaces.
So, to be continued.
To be continued.
Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine, her article this week, Your Reckoning and Mine, as stories about abuse, assault, and complicity come flooding out. How do we think about the culprits in our lives, including sometimes ourselves? Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.